being a cheat. You even told the mothers on me, she adds, pretending to be wounded. You roughed up the edges of the stickers. I could see exactly what you'd done, so of course I knew. I recall the look on her innocent face when I called her out on it all those years ago, then watched Mother Tabia give her a stern talking to. Imagine how good you'd feel if you did it properly. Are you forgetting it's just a toy? She asks, her eyebrow raised. You'll get a real sense of achievement. Let's test your theory, she says, holding the colourful object in front of us. Fine. I smile, my eyes absorbing the pattern of colours while my brain works out the best way to start. Put your right hand on the top section and rotate it just once to the left. Holly misunderstands my instruction and turns the top two-thirds of the cube rather than just the upper layer. No! I shriek, stifling a laugh at how my insides churned with anxiety at her mistake. Perhaps she's right, and I do need to remember that it's just a toy. Go back to where we started. She does as I ask. Right, I say, looping my arm through hers so that my right hand hovers above hers. I curl my fingers as though the cube is in my own hands and repeat the instruction, showing her what to do. Now turn the cube around so that the yellow of this side is at the bottom and... I demonstrate. She understands and turns. That's three yellows in a row, she yelps, delighted with herself. You really did cheat if you think that's an achievement, I giggle, sweeping my hair away from my face and over the opposite shoulder from where Holly is sitting. Her eyes snatch a glimpse of my newly exposed neck and I notice her lips give the smallest pout in response before she focuses back on the cube. My body tingles at this new level of intimacy and craves more. I tentatively feed my arm through hers again so that we can continue as before. But this time I don't say a word. I just instruct with my hands. She mirrors them perfectly, taking note of exactly how my hands rotate, turn, and manipulate before doing the same with her own. A silence might have fallen between us, but something entirely new is being communicated. I feel her. I know that's absurd, but I do. With our arms interlinked and our bodies sitting closer than usual, we're sharing a new energy. I'm aware of her every breath working its way in and out of her body, each and every muscle as she mimics my movements, and that she is just as aware of the change as I am. It's not in my imagination. It's real. I know she feels it too. It's titillating, tantalizing, and stirs an inexplicable hunger inside me. I want her. I don't need words to define the thoughts being shared, not when my insides are flipping with excitement at the tingling sensation of her body next to mine. We've done it, she says quietly, holding the completed puzzle in her hands, neither of us engaged in the game any longer. We remain in silence. My thoughts are focused on the heat passing down the right side of my body. It's real. The feelings that are being stirred are here and alive, and I won't have anyone tell me different. Time passes. It could be seconds, or it could be hours. I've no idea. I should go. She taps the top of the cube, then gets to her feet. She starts to say something else, but stops herself. Instead, she turns on the heels of her jelly wedges and heads indoors. I've made a decision, I call, looking at the clouds beyond my feet. I'll go for science. I don't need to turn to know that she's gone. Chapter 20. Eve. I stay sitting on the drop for some time, trying to calm down and make sure my cheeks aren't still pink from our encounter. Encounter. An unusual giddiness has risen within me, a warm, fuzzy excitement. I've needed time to digest it, to enjoy it, but also to quash it until I can dwell on its inevitable disappointing outcome, which I'm hoping to delay for as long as possible. I have to choose science, because I couldn't handle meeting potential number three and not feeling that, whatever that was. While sitting here, I focus on the perfection in front of me. It's a sight I try never to take for granted. Living here, seeing the earth in all its beauty spurs me on. The greens of the land I occasionally glimpse in the distance, the blues of the sky. It's all so inviting. It fills me with love for Mother Nature, even though she's revealed her flaws, or perhaps she's exercising her strength to warn us of the magnitude of her power. She's in charge, that's for sure. Try as we may, we cannot bend her laws. Not if she doesn't want us to. Is it wrong that I'm starting to take solace from that? A bell tells me it's time for the afternoon session to start. Gardening. Holly doesn't join me for this. Sometimes reality and illusion just aren't compatible. A lesson that's all about respecting the earth, nurturing life and seeing it thrive at the touch of your fingertips could be ironic with Holly in attendance. I don't mind her absence, as it's a class I get lost in anyway. I always find any manual task highly therapeutic. I need that today, right now. And the last thing I need is one of the other Hollies. Mother Kimberly is waiting for me when I arrive at my allotment across the dome. Elsewhere, the mothers grow all the fruit and vegetables we eat at each meal, but this patch is just for me. It's filled with flowers. Roses, daffodils, lavender, clematis, delphiniums, and poppies. To name just a few. I pick up my secateurs and snip off dead blooms and yellowing leaves. "Are you well?" asks Mother Kimberly, her rounded frame pulling out two brown folding chairs from my shed and taking a seat. She looks as she normally does, in her navy gardening trousers, cream cotton blouse and trainers, with her short red hair curling around her ears. But there's a weariness behind her glistening blue eyes, which usually sparkle with happiness. And there's a tightness in her lips, which are usually smiling. She looks shattered. I've forgotten the toll recent events must be taking on the mothers, too. It'll be a long time before things feel normal again. If they ever do. I let out an exaggerated sigh. She nods in response, sympathy on her rosy face as she purses her lips in a straight line. I heard. I don't even want to look at another potential, so how could I let one touch me? I ask, removing the rosebuds that have failed to bloom and shriveled on the bush, thereby directing more energy into those that show more promise. I'm learning to grow life. You don't know how you'll feel about this one until you're in his company, Mother Kimberly advises, her tone all-knowing. I usually enjoy it when the mothers share some of the knowledge from their experiences before the current structure was formed, although I'm not sure they always understand what it's like to be me. I don't think I'm going to be in his company, I say bluntly. Oh. I watch her face drop as she understands what I've said and feel a pang of guilt. That's a shame. You think so? I ask, picking up an empty bucket and disposing of the bits I've been hacking off. Any children you deliver will be partly made of him, Mother Kimberly says firmly, her neck straightening a little as she tries to remain diplomatic. I doubt she'll tell me I'm wrong, it's not in her nature, but I'm expecting her to share her thoughts on the subject. Does that matter? I ask. Does it matter to you that half of you came from your father? That you only exist because of him? She asks slowly, her head tilting to one side. Do you ever find yourself wondering if you're like him in any way? I'm rarely asked such a direct question about him. He features in my thoughts, but they focus mostly on my mother. I don't reply because not only is there truth in what she said, but also she knows the answers to each of her loaded questions. Wouldn't your child feel the same? Maybe, I mumble. My life has been so geared towards meeting the potentials and finding my perfect match that I've hardly thought beyond the act of procreation at the revival. Until very recently, I hadn't really thought about life with a child. A baby. My baby. Surely the most significant part in all this is bringing life into the world. It was for my mother. She had plans for me. For us. She'd thought through our lives together. I wonder what kind of mother I'll be, and whether I'll even be allowed to raise my children, if I'm lucky enough to have any. They may be taken from me, raised by another group of mothers and given their own Holly to grow up with. The thought of them going through that fills me with dread. What would happen if I bore a boy? Would we just keep going until another girl is born? That's why they're starting me so young, surely. To get the most out of me while they can. I'm old enough to remember a time before you, Mother Kimberly sniffs. She leans forward in her chair, rubbing her hands together while she rests her elbows on her knees. The tests, the hormone treatments, the poking, the prodding, all of it to no avail. They were sure the fault lay somewhere with us women and needed to find out what it was. Eventually, we were considered worthless. That was until your mother and father. I stop pruning and look up at her, letting her know she's got my full attention now. Your mother was a very special woman. Did you know her? I ask. My interest piqued. Now I'm starting to understand the woman who carried me for 9 months. I want to hear everything there is to know about her. Not personally, she admits, with a touch of sadness. My heart drops with disappointment. She glances around us to ensure no one is in earshot, then continues, her voice low and gravelly, quite different from the delicate sound I'm used to hearing from her. But one of the things that made her special to us women wasn't that she fell pregnant with a girl, but that she had done so away from a laboratory. Whatever your mother and father shared was more efficient than a bunch of men and women in white coats telling us our bodies were useless. She was tested, the same as everyone else. I've read about it in her own letters, her thoughts of failings echoing Mother Kimberly's. She was one of you. Yes, she was told she was of no use and was sent home to your father. So the story goes, she adds, with a non-committal shrug that suggests I'm not the only one to have my suspicions about what we're told. I realize it's not just me being kept in the dark. That's true, I nod. My mother wrote about it. Yes. A smile appears on her face but doesn't quite reach her eyes. I wonder if it's for my benefit or theirs. I just wonder if the power of attraction and emotion should be so quickly overlooked, Eve. Science has failed us before. I'm sure it's advanced since then. What else have they been doing all this time? I ask. Mother Kimberly shakes her head. She thinks I've not listened, that her words have gone in one ear and straight out the other. But she's wrong. I've heard them, and they've made me stand even firmer in my decision. Science has failed before. Maybe it'll fail now. Secretly, that's what I'm hoping for. Because being responsible for bringing another human, my child or not, into this world doesn't feel like the right thing to do. And maybe, just maybe, their experimental meddling was Mother Nature's reason for attempting to kill us off in the first place.
Chapter 21. Bram. I can't sleep. No surprises there, I guess, although tonight is different. Usually it's my brain that keeps me awake, thinking about the missions, the future, and Eve, of course. During the day, a river of thoughts is held at bay behind a dam inside my head, but each night it bursts and the river drowns any chance I had of sleep. But tonight it's not my mind that's keeping me awake. It's a feeling, a physical feeling, that somewhere in the core of my body something is leaping around. I suppose they call this butterflies, although that seems to paint a far gentler mental image than what I'm experiencing. Mine are trapped hummingbirds, flapping tirelessly to and fro, their wings relentlessly strumming the strings of my emotions as I lie in my bunk. A small pop breaks the silence, and I roll over to see Hartman sitting in the glow of his reading light at his desk in the far corner of the dorm. It's called bubblegum, he says, sensing my eyes on him. Huh? I reply. He purses his lips, and a blue bubble starts to appear. It grows and pops, splattering over his nose. It's vintage, he says, throwing a small, shiny, rectangular piece of paper to me. Try it. Jeez, it smells sweet, I say, folding back the silver foil and sniffing the blue strip of gum inside. Don't waste it, that stuff ain't cheap. Thanks, I say, avoiding having to try it by subtly slipping it into the chest pocket of my jumpsuit. You've not stopped rubbing your fingers together for the past 30 minutes, he says, and I'm suddenly aware that I've been massaging the spot where Eve was touching me earlier, remembering the sensation that my kinetic gloves were creating on my fingers, that she was creating, as she guided my hands around that cube. "You know, you pushed it to the line again today, dude," Hartman says, and I can't help but feel he's finding this subject difficult to approach. "You do realize that I could tell what was going on, both of you playing along, that you were intent on completing the Rubik's Cube, which, by the way, was obviously a totally romantic gesture on your part. Okay, maybe it's not so difficult for him to approach it. We both know she can solve that thing in no more than 20 moves. I know you can too. I've sat here watching you twiddle it around, slept through the constant clicking when you were figuring it out years ago. But today she repeatedly made mistakes, purposely directing you to make wrong turns, allowing your time on the drop to last that little bit longer." I don't say anything. What can I say? He's totally right. "Look, if I can see it, then you can bet your next set of stitches that your dad can too, and if by some freaky miracle he can't, then Miss Silver certainly can." He waits for me to fill the silence. But I've got nothing to say. "You've got to be careful. Sometimes I wish they didn't heal you up so good. Then you'd have the scars to remind you of what happens when you break the rules here. Your dad may not punish you publicly, but he sure as hell makes you pay for it, dude." He sighs. "Today was the longest Eve and I have had physical contact," I say, staring up at the underside of Hartman's bunk. "I know it's forbidden." "Exactly. Think how many pilots have lost their jobs, or worse, for that exact reason. Lucas, Kook, that other guy with the weird nose, Saunders. Yeah, all of them slowly falling in love with her, then pushing the boundaries of their missions. It's a criminal offence, Bram. Anything that could potentially put her at risk. That's a prison sentence, dude," Hartman warns me. "Don't think I can't see what's going on with you two." He knows me too well. He knows her too. Plus, he's right. It's beyond stupid. I used to laugh at those pilots who came here, swore their oath to the EPO, and then, wham, fell in love with Eve within the first few months on the job. Saunders, Lucas, Kook. Idiots. I'd grown up with her and managed to remain professional. Always kept my intentions, my motivations clear. Why this change? Why now? Where have these feelings come from? Am I jealous of the potentials? Maybe. Has this love been born out of the fear of losing Eve now that she's been called upon to fulfill her destiny? Did I just use the word love? Maybe I've always loved her. "Hello," her innocent voice calls. "What's your name?" "I'm Holly," I reply, staring at Eve's incredible face through the prototype visor my father has just finished. Her big blue eyes are trying to figure me out, as though they're staring into my mind even though we aren't even in the same room. "Who are you really?" she says. So smart. I feel the nervous energy from the grown-ups surrounding me, even though I can't see them beyond the visor on my face. "Cut it off," I hear Vivian whisper to my father, followed by a rustle of his shirt as he moves to end this session. "I'm a kid," I tell Eve quickly. My father pauses. "Just like you." Eve looks at me. My insides flutter. "I'm Eve," she says, trying to suppress a smile. I sense the glances around the room. "Can we be friends?" I say the line as I was instructed to before the session began. "Maybe," she teases. I sigh. "What?" Hartman asks. "Do you think..." I stop myself asking the question. "What?" I look at him. I can trust him, more than anyone. "That she feels it too." He rolls his eyes, then lets his head hit the table. "Oh my God, Bram, I can't believe you said that. I mean, I know you two have been getting closer. I can see that. Anyone can see that. But seriously, dude, this is Eve. The person you're talking about, the girl you're asking me if I think she's feeling things for you, is Eve. The savior of humanity. E-V-E. I shouldn't have opened my mouth. I mean, I thought that was how you were feeling, but I never really thought it. You know what I mean? I never thought you'd be dumb enough to act on those feelings, to let it start affecting our missions. Okay, forget I said anything. Oh, believe me, I will. I'm going to erase this whole conversation from my memory, then empty the trash," he says, while pretending to tip the contents of his brain into the bin next to his desk. "I'm going for a shower. Actually, no, you are." "What?" I ask as he points to the bathroom in our dorm. You, shower, now. You need to cool off. Wash off this craziness and come out with a clear head. I want old Bram back. Professional Bram, top of the leaderboards Bram, not this lovesick Romeo zombie that's going to get us both locked up for the rest of our lives. Shower, now, he orders. I reluctantly peel myself from the bed and walk to the shower with my tail between my legs. Well, that didn't go so well, Bram, did it, you complete dumbass? The shower is cold, but I welcome it. I need it. It's refreshing and instantly clears my mind. The only problem is that it clears away the last 15-minute lecture from Hartman, and now all I'm left with is a fresh flutter of hummingbirds as the cold water reinvigorates them. The thing is, he may know Eve, but he doesn't know her like I do. This isn't just in my head. Things have changed since she saw my face. She knows what I look like now, the face behind Holly. When she sees Holly, does she see her or me? More importantly, whose face does she want to see? I step out of the shower. The water stops automatically and the soft buzz begins of the recycling process that cleans the water and pumps it back into the system. I look at my face in the mirror. My deep brown eyes study themselves, searching for something. An answer? A sign? Jesus Christ, Bram, pull yourself together. I know I pushed the boundaries today, I can't deny that. The rules are black and white. Holly must not initiate physical contact with Eve. Simple as. But when it comes to Eve initiating physical contact with Holly, that's a grey area. Today was a totally grey mission. I guess I went fishing with the cube and Eve took the bait. I can't promise I won't go fishing again. I dry myself and head back to my bunk. Better? Hartman calls. Much better, thanks, I reply. Look, let's just forget what I said earlier, okay? Forget what? He says, not bothering to look up from whatever he's reading. I climb onto my bed with my hummingbirds, place my hands together and get back to staring at the bunk above, thinking of what will happen next time I see Eve.
Chapter 22. Eve. They might have created this pretty dome for me to grow up in, but the laboratories of my early years had never been far away. They followed me here. Specially built stark white clinical rooms for me to visit twice a month for scans and blood tests. It's so routine and monotonous that I'm usually unfazed by having to recline in a hospital chair and splay my legs in stirrups so they can get to work. Today is different. I'm nervous. I'm tense. Usually I'm here so they can observe any changes in my body. They practically held a party when I first started ovulating. Today, the room feels even more cold and barren now a serious task is at hand. Hold your knee up into your side, Dr. Rankin says, without looking at me as she adjusts her prodding stick, causing me to wince at the sensation. I've had the same doctor my entire life, but there is no personal relationship between us, no niceties, even though she's seen more of me than almost anyone else. I am a scientific puzzle to her, nothing more. I wonder what would happen if I successfully had girls and this doctor were to die. She must be in her 70s at least, judging by the multiple folds in the skin around her hazel eyes and the S-shaped curve of her spine. Her white coat hangs loosely over her skinny frame and her walk has turned into a shuffle since I've been seeing her. She's not aging particularly well. At some point, she will perish like the rest of them. Will my female children be studied like this, exposed to a man? My body constricts at the thought. Keep still, Dr. Rankin barks, her large nostrils flaring angrily. Sorry, I mumble. Thoughts? Vivian asks over me. She's been standing silently in the corner for the last few minutes. She doesn't usually bother coming, but today is different. She didn't seem surprised when I told her I was choosing not to meet potential number three. In fact, it was the first time I've seen something resembling relief flit across her stony features. We're early, but I should be able to retract in a week or so. We'll need to monitor closely until then, Dr. Rankin replies, squinting at the screen in front of her through her thick-rimmed glasses. Retraction is nothing new. They probably have a freezer drawer somewhere full of my unfertilized eggs, But this time, my eggs are being taken on a different journey. Rather than being stilled and preserved, they will be encouraged to live and flourish, to help me fulfill my destiny. How many will there be? Vivian asks, walking around so that she has a clear view of the screen. I never get to see what's on it. I'm never shown my insides, although I doubt I'd understand what I was looking at even if they pivoted the screen in my direction. I predict only one or two in this cycle, Dr. Rankin replies, the tip of her index finger tapping twice on the image before them. They're a good, healthy size, though. Exactly what we want. Great. Vivian's eyes are glued to them. There'll be more next month if things don't work out this cycle. They will, Vivian declares, with the forward tilt of her head that I know means she's demanding her desired outcome. She doesn't want to think about Plan B. I can only do so much. There are still some variables, as we know, Dr. Rankin reminds her. Well, limit them. The two women look at each other, and for a split second, it seems they're about to clash. Then Dr. Rankin nods multiple times, conceding to the one in charge. I'll need a fresh sample from the donor, Dr. Rankin tells Vivian as she taps the screen. Fine. Daily, she adds authoritatively. Fine. She forces the word out in a growl. I can practically hear her teeth grind at being given orders to follow. Koa is already here, she adds. I decided not to look at potential number three's file, but now I have a name. Koa. I wonder what his background is and where he's from, what heritage he'll be passing on along with his aesthetics. The donor. That is what I've demoted the possible father of the future to. Some swimmers in a cup. The rod is moved and I yelp. Honestly, Dr. Rankin hisses, before turning back to Vivian. We'll fertilize both and pick the one with the stronger grading. If both are outstanding, I'd advise against implanting them together at this time. We can discuss that if it occurs. Vivian clearly disagrees with the medical advice. It's early days and I advise we take things slowly. There is the risk of it being too much of a strain on her body, given the medical history of her mother. Doctor, Vivian spits, know your position. Dr. Rankin is stunned into silence, her cheeks burning a bright red. She doesn't utter another sound as she peels off her surgical gloves and leaves the room. Vivian gives the screen one last hard stare, then, without a glance in my direction, follows her out of the open door. I breathe a sigh of relief that it's over, taking a second or two to stop myself crying, then freeing my legs from the stirrups. I sit up on the bed and take a moment to still my racing heart. Chapter 23. Eve. You seem distracted, she observes, while we put on our shoes at the end of another dance class. I needed that physical activity. I've been transported from my worries and freed as my body bent, twirled and kicked, spinning unwanted thoughts from my head at great speed. Now we've stopped. It's time to interact as the anguish elbows its way back in. I've avoided talking to Holly the whole session, but this one is never shrugged off without a struggle. She's persistent and not in an endearing way. I don't trust know-it-all Holly. Do I? I frown at the floor, letting her know I'm not in the mood for her today. Anything on your mind? She asks, pushing me further. I understand she's meant to seem caring and concerned, but instead she sounds false. There's plenty on my mind, I snap. Care to share? No. I bet you would if we were out on the drop. What do you mean? I ask, looking up at her pinched face. I never see the beauty in this one, even though she's the same aesthetically as the others. She makes Holly ugly, which is no easy feat. Nothing, she says, a little startled at being pulled up on her comment. Right. I feel my back prickle in self-defense. It's just you seem to open up more there. Must be the view, I retort, leaving the room and slamming the door behind me. I shower off the day and throw on a loose-fitting, black floor-length summer dress. I leave my hair to dry naturally, letting it hang over my shoulders, then head barefooted to the drop. I ache to see her. It irks me that the special connection with my Holly has been noted, but something within me doesn't care. We're currently counting down to a life-altering change that is beyond my control and will imprison me more inescapably than ever. This is it. The last bit of time for me. The end of my so-called youth. What took you so long? I ask, a few minutes later. I feel as if I've been sitting on my own for hours, even though I know it could only have been a few minutes. As I ask the question, I suddenly feel a pang of fear that it's not her. It is, and my smile grows in a way that it never has before, surprising me. That cements what I already know. Nothing, she shrugs, giving a subtle frown. What are you wearing? She looks down and her jaw drops at the sight of her frilly lace pink gown. It's awful. Just a casual number, she laughs, breezily arching her back against the metal pole frame of the drop and stretching out her arms in a dramatic pose. Oh, it suits you. You think? She asks, a cheeky glint in her eye that causes another smile to form on my lips. I'll have to see if they do something similar in my size, I say, through muffled giggles. You've always been such a fashion icon to me. Vivian would be so pleased that I'm following your lead. I'm sure she would. I enjoy the easy laughter that descends upon us. So, how was it? She asks, draping her arms over a railing and looking out at the view. As horrendous as I imagine? It was fine, I lie. Crazy to think a small part of me is going to be meeting him in some science lab downstairs soon. And that something so tiny has the potential to have such a huge impact on the world, she says, not looking at me. That too, I say. But the thought of what will take place the next couple of times I'm in that room is making me feel uneasy. It's what I've chosen, but that doesn't mean I want it to happen. It was simply the lesser of two evils. Did it hurt? She asks quietly, catching my eye before bashfully looking at the clouds below. Her question surprises me, mostly because of the genuine anguish on her face, as though any pain I might have felt would affect her too somehow. I shake my head, giving a non-committal smile that I know she'll see through. Sorry, she says, trying to gather the endless material of her dress behind her knees so that she can sit next to me. There's so much that it's not an easy maneuver. If it weren't for the current topic of conversation, I'd find her struggles hilarious. It's not your fault, I say, tearing my eyes away from her to look ahead. It's the world we live in, the life I was born into. I should be used to it. Yeah, she says. She opens her mouth to say more, but stops. She blows out a lungful of air. And I was used to it, I say, thoughtfully, letting my mind wander. There was a proper plan before, and I knew what lay ahead of me. I didn't expect this series of events. No one could have predicted it. I guess not. We sit in silence for a few moments. A comfortable one, but it's a rarity for us nonetheless. Do you ever wonder what it would be like to live in a different time? Like when? She asks, moving her weight backwards so that she's resting on her elbows and looking at the sky above. I copy her. I don't know, I sigh. The 1960s, when they danced all the time? I suggest the first era that pops into my head. I think it was a happier time in our history. I bet they didn't really. Are you saying my history lessons are founded on lies? No, she stammers. I laugh. Or maybe the 17th century, where I could have been a grand thespian on the stage, spouting Shakespeare in a melodramatic voice, I say, swinging my arms around. Young boys played girls' roles back then. You'd have had no chance, she giggles with me. I can't help but turn my head so that I can take in her perfectly sloped, upturned nose and pink heart-shaped lips. A boy playing a girl. Fancy that. What is it that makes you wonder about those times? She coughs, her laughter dying. Sitting up, she scratches her ankle, as though it's not the conversation that's made her move. I just bet it was simpler. My eye is drawn to a little black dot far away in the clouds above. I watch it flicker and hover. They all had their troubles, she says, turning to me and gesturing for me to sit up. And I'm just not told of them, I ask, seeing the raised scar on my wrist as I pushed myself into a sitting position. "You know more than me," she states, which is probably true, as she doesn't come to those classes with me. I've no idea what Bram knows about our history, or if what I know is even true. We joke, but they could have rewritten the whole lot to brainwash me into their way of thinking. There may be huge chunks of our past that I know nothing about, because they've decided they aren't right for me, and I wouldn't have a clue. My mum trusted Vivian and the team around her. She'd suffered loss after loss, and suddenly a powerful figure was taking care of her, saying they'd do everything in their power to bring her daughter safely into the world. Of course she trusted them. Of course she listened to their advice and did all they asked of her. She trusted their knowledge. She must have felt she had no other choice. I've lived under their knowledge for 16 years, and although I might not have my mum's experience of life out there, the manipulation in here has fogged my vision for long enough. It's time things changed. It's time to break down that wall and see through the cracks. I wonder what it was like back then to fall freely and unequivocally in love, I say, my voice shaking. I know where I want this to lead. To follow your heart's desire. To do exactly as it directs and not hold back. Every generation had rules, Eve, she comments, adding flippantly, except the 1960s, then they seemed to do whatever the hell they liked. So I've heard, I say, although I can't recall anything particularly interesting about that decade. I wonder what it was like for my mother and father to find love. Love? She asks, her voice soft as the energy around us shifts, becoming charged once more. Yeah, to find each other in a sea of thousands, I add, forcing myself to continue, because I want to. I want to say these things to him. Don't you ever feel a grief over that? A loss for what should have been? We should have had that right. Love can't be contained. But they've contained us. He flounders. I've caught him off guard. Him. She is only he to me now. I've become more aware of it in every conversation we've shared, in every thought I have of us when we're not together. I barely see Holly anymore. I just see those dark brown eyes. I see Bram. Do you want to know the one thing I'm sad about? I ask, my insides flipping. What? He croaks. That I'll never find out what it's like to be kissed. Properly kissed. By someone I love. That sentence takes my breath away. Now I've said it, I have to wait for him to grasp what I'm yearning for him to do. I keep my eyes low and almost closed as I turn my face in his direction. My lips prickle at the thought of what's to come and how desperately I want it to happen. A huge part of me is scared he'll just disappear before we get the chance. But it can't be rushed. Ever so slowly, I'm aware of his face behind hers, moving towards mine. The world stops turning. I hold my breath as I lean over, my face edging closer to my best friend. My Holly, dressed in a ridiculous pink outfit, yet looking as beautiful as ever. My lips become fuller. I close my eyes to see only him in my mind. Kiss me, I whisper. Then I feel him.
Chapter 24. Bram. Connection lost. The words blind me as they illuminate the inside of my visor. What happened? I blast, holding my thumb and little finger together to speak directly to Hartman in case Eve can still hear me. Eve. Our lips touch for the briefest moment. My first kiss with a female. Her first kiss ever. And it was over almost before it had begun. Hartman, what's happening? Are we disconnected? I ask, growing more frustrated at losing the moment. Eve chose me. I know she wasn't kissing Holly. It was me she was reaching out to, the real me. I slip off my visor, half expecting to have it ripped from my hands and smashed around my head again. Instead, I'm greeted with a far more concerning sight. "Miss Silver," I say, dipping my head in respect as her unmistakable silhouette catches my eye while my vision adjusts to the darkness of the room. I've never seen her in the studio before. Something moves in my peripheral vision. I take a quick glance and see Hartman being escorted by security out through the door and into the locker room. "That's mine. It's got sensitive data on it," he cries as the guard rips his drive from the terminal and drops it into a black plastic bag. "I think we need to have a talk, Bram, don't you?" Vivian says calmly, hands behind her back, her cold face catching the dimmed lights of the studio. Hartman is shoved out of the room and the door hisses shut. It's just me and Vivian now. I'm suddenly cold and very aware of how exposed I feel, wearing nothing but a lycra bodysuit in front of her. She says nothing, but instead lets my brain do the work for her. The silence is intimidating. She emits power so effortlessly that I'm defeated already. "Hartman had nothing to do with that. It was all me," I say. "That may be so, but you are a team and the actions of one impact on the other. He could have asked you to stop. He could have made us aware if he was troubled by your recent behavior." "You mean report me?" I ask. "Precisely. He is the only one of your team not to have done so." She pauses to let those words sink in. "The entire squad have reported me. Have I been that reckless? Have my actions been so obviously selfish? Have I actually put in jeopardy what we're trying to achieve, the future of humanity?" My heart is beating almost as fast as it was a few moments ago, when my lips were millimeters away from Eve's. Almost. "You're suspended, Bram," Vivian says. "You and Hartman."
"No, you can't. Not now. We're so close. This is what we've been working towards our entire lives. She needs me right now," I beg, realizing I won't be able to see Eve. "I'll never get that moment back. Have you forgotten your place?" Vivian says calmly, almost as though she revels in my panic. "Eve doesn't need you. Eve does not need Bram Wells. Eve needs Holly." She corrects my obvious blunder. "Eve will get her scheduled time with Holly as she always does. Except the person behind the eyes will not be you until you have proven to us that you are once again up to the standard we require of our pilots." I can't look at her. There's so much history between us. I've grown up here. I've stood in front of her as a boy, being given my orders for what she wanted me to get Eve to do. Now I'm 18, a man, but I feel like that little boy again. "You're to take a week to retrain yourself, to get your head back into shape. We need you, Bram, now more than ever, but I cannot allow you to be with Eve until you remember why we're all here. We need you, but you're still replaceable." Vivian stares at me, and I bow my head to let her know that I've heard her words, that I have absorbed and understood them. She turns to leave and waits for the door to slide open. Before she goes, she glances back at me. "Oh, and Bram, it's not just your career on the line. If you don't get back into shape, you'll be escorted from the tower and off base for good. Out into the world down there. You and Hartman. Don't forget that."
"You idiot!" I scream at myself as I punch the locker. I pull my fist out of the dent that has formed around my knuckles and thrust it back in, making the dent twice as deep. "What are you thinking, you complete moron?" I slam my head into the sheet metal and hold it there, trying to calm the raging thoughts in my brain. "Yeah, exactly. What were you thinking?" Hartman interrupts my moment of self-punishment as he enters the locker room carrying the black bin liner containing his hard drive. "I'm so sorry, man. I just got carried away. She lent him for the kiss and I..." Okay, I get it," he says, and I can't help but notice his concerned frown. "Dude, are you all right?" He places his hard drive on the bench and approaches me. It's only as watery droplets frame my vision and blur the edges of the room that I realize I'm crying. Yeah, I'm fine." I laugh it off, wiping away the tears before they fall. "It's just a bit overwhelming, all this. I know it's hard for you, Bram. You've grown up with Eve.
You spent your whole life working towards what's about to happen in the next few weeks, and it's natural that you're going to feel more emotional about it than the rest of us. Hartman tries his best to console me. If he weren't so off the mark, it would probably have had some impact. Sure, everything he's saying is correct. It is more emotional for me than the others. I've been here from the start, and we're approaching the moment we've all been working so hard for, but the truth is, I don't think I'm upset about that. As I search my brain, the thing that keeps coming back to me is that somehow I have to finish that kiss.
Chapter 25. Eve. The kiss. The kiss. The kiss. I sit there with my eyes closed for what feels like hours. Every little hair is standing on end. My whole body feels alive, wanted and wanton. Heat gathers at the spot where our lips met, then disperses, touching every inch of me, even my toes. I breathe into it, loving the silent buzz that surrounds us, numbing any rational thought that might be urging me to stop. I won't. I don't want to hear it. Not now. Nothing else matters. Just that kiss. When I feel him leaving, when I know they've taken him from me, I stay there, kissing the air, still able to feel the energy we've created, thanks to the burning sensation on my lips. My body is relaxed, and I'm the happiest and most content I've felt in ages. Possibly ever. Who'd have thought one of the Hollies could make me feel like this? Perhaps I should feel foolish for not having spotted the potential spark between us sooner. Potential spark. Potential. Could Bram be a potential? Would they allow it? The butterflies swirling in my tummy tell me it has to be a possibility. I don't know why I didn't think of it sooner. Whatever hoops they made Connor, Diego, and Koa run through to get into that meeting room, whatever tests they completed, whatever special DNA they carry to have made it as a potential, can't be compared to the natural chemistry between Bram and me. It's the same as what happened with my mother and father. Like them, what we share is real. It's magical. And they allowed me to make a decision about the last meeting with a potential. That must mean my own opinions and desires have some weight, finally, so they'll listen. Suddenly my mouth curls into the biggest grin my face has ever cracked and a giggle spills out of me, forcing me to cover my mouth with both hands as the laughter grows. The cold metal of the drop is beneath me as my back collapses against the floor. I was blind before to the oppression and control. Even if that's not the intention of those who lovingly care for me, like the mothers. I've always known the direction my life is heading, my purpose. But as I look at the blue skies above me, I'm hit by an overwhelming sense of hope. For once, the future holds something special for me. I finally care about it, and the life I may be able to live that would fill me with happiness. I wonder how they could change the current arrangements to accommodate Bram, and whether there would be a proper meeting, like I had with Connor and Diego. It would be awkward with everyone surrounding us, and I know I wasn't keen on having one with Koa, but this is different. I know Bram to some extent, and he certainly knows me. This meeting wouldn't be for us to confirm what we already know about our connection, but to highlight the strength of our feelings to them, so that they couldn't dispute them. They would have to support us. I don't see how they couldn't. Minutes and hours pass while I dream, wondering what the next stages might be. I even think of our wedding. They probably don't happen very often now, with the numbers dwindling outside, but it would give the people a surge of hope that the old life is returning for future generations. Then there are the living arrangements to think about. I wonder if he'd move up here into the dome with me. It would make sense for my life partner to be at my side, not living out there with everyone else. How wonderful it would be to wake up in the morning and have another person sleeping next to me. A constant companion, not just someone they send in to see me when they're after something. Most importantly, I think about our children. I wonder what they would look like. Would they have his dark brown eyes or my bright blue ones? My curly brown hair or something more like his? Would their faces be square or round like mine? I'm lost in the possibilities that lie ahead. Each question leads to another, and before I know it, the sun is nearing the horizon. Darkness is seeping in to engulf the drop. It's only when I notice day turning into night that I realize something isn't quite right. No one has been sent in Holly's place. Not another Holly, not a mother, not even Vivian. I've been allowed out here alone. It's possible that the incident has caused commotion among the Hollies, but even if that were so, no mother has been sent to usher me inside, and Vivian hasn't been out to reprimand me for earlier and banish me to my room. There's been nothing. I've just been left here to dream. They've allowed me to spend longer than ever before out on the drop on my own. And not just by a few minutes, but by hours. A small part of me wants to believe that it's because they witnessed what Bram and I did and are busy hatching new plans that involve us both. But a larger part of me is worried it means something more sinister. A chill creeps over my shoulders and I shiver. Slowly I bring my feet up from their dangling position and pull my knees protectively into my chest. Suddenly I don't feel so free and light. With my heart full of apprehension, I stand and start back along the walkway into the dome. Wandering through the garden zones, which are usually scattered with a few of the mothers tending the plants, I pass no one. I am alone. Moving on to the cafeteria, where I usually have my evening meal, there is nothing and no one. No food. No people. Nothing. As a last resort, I find myself walking to the last place I ever want to go. Vivian's room. Knocking on her closed door, I'm greeted by nothing. There is no answer. She's either not there or is ignoring me. Either way, I'm surrounded by nothing but an eerie silence. This is how I am being punished. I bow my head. Loneliness speaks louder than any words of discouragement or disappointment. It hurts more, too. Words of annoyance or disbelief I could have shrugged off, but the desolation they've left me with is deflating and cruel. Why would they let me fall so far from such a high? I fear I already know the answer. It's to remind me that without them, I am completely alone. Chapter 26. Eve. I don't sleep much. Instead, the events of the day play over and over in my mind. A moment of total bliss followed by the crushing despair of knowing I'm being punished for experiencing a forbidden joy. However naive, I still hold on to the hope that they'll see sense in my thinking. After all, we'd be working with Mother Nature, not fighting against her. Likewise, they'd have my full cooperation and I'd be happy, not acting like the sulky teenager they've turned me into with their bullying. Even though there's so much to think about, I must have drifted into sleep at some point during the night, because when I wake up, it's morning and the sun is shining through my window as usual. For a nanosecond, I find myself wondering whether everything has returned to normal. Perhaps they've decided they've made their point and that I needn't continue my exile. Maybe they even want to talk through my ideas. I soon realize I'm wrong. Silence fills my ears and my bedroom door remains closed. No mother sent in with my breakfast or to get me ready for the day. Nothing. My stomach grumbles. After missing dinner last night, I'm hungry. It's quite an alien sensation for me. I wait a few minutes to be sure no one's coming, but when my door fails to open, I decide to get myself ready. It's a ridiculous notion, my having to rely on the mothers for everything anyway. It's not as though they can do it for the rest of my life. I walk into my bathroom and undress myself. While I'm removing my nightdress, I catch a glimpse of my naked flesh in the mirror. I stop and walk towards it. I rarely get a chance to look at myself in this way. There's always someone watching, eager to move me along and get me ready for the day ahead. But now they're not here, I have the freedom to study myself. My eyes trace the pertness of my lopsided breasts, my small waist and the curve of my hips, all covered with smooth, pale skin. Is this what a woman's body is supposed to look like? Having nothing to compare it to, I find myself wondering if it would be pleasing for others to look at. Does it matter? Yes, because of Bram. I want him to see me like this and enjoy what he sees. The thought fills me with an unexpected sadness. The fact that I'm standing here alone does not bode well for my dreams. I choke back my tears as I go into the shower, the only place I can cry without being seen.
Chapter 27. Bram. So, day one of my suspension sucked. I killed time mainly by pacing the dorm, cursing the situation, trying not to think of Eve, but mostly failing. I was glad to get into bed and looked forward to sleep giving my mind a rest. Sleep that appeared briefly, then disappeared. I've been awake now for 3 hours and 22 minutes. I guess day two of my suspension has begun. Day two of pacing the slick floors of our small room. Not that I can't leave and kill time in other areas of this vast, city-sized building, but without any idea of what's happening up in the dome, without knowing when I'll see Eve again, I've lost my purpose. Hartman is still sleeping. He's taking it well, considering none of it is his fault, but I feel stabs of guilt deep in my gut when I think of how I've risked our futures. His snoring is reassuring, though, even comforting. I roll over and peep out from my bunk up at his and see a few wisps of curly brown hair poking out, flapping in the breeze of his breath. Despite all that's happening, he can still sleep so soundly. We are of the lucky elite who live their lives behind the protective walls of this tower. We're not equipped for life out there anymore, and if we were to lose this, I can't even think about it. What am I doing, playing with his life like this? I've had enough of rolling around in my sweat-soaked sheets. I pull them off and slide quietly out of my bunk. I slip on my casuals, still emblazoned with the EPO logo, still uniform, but comfortable. If I can find anything to be happy about today, it's that I don't have to wear the compulsory navy blue jumpsuit and boots. I walk barefoot to my glass desk, which illuminates as I sit. The paper notes and heaps of files glow from underneath as the system recognizes my face, and the hollow screen projects my welcome image, a photograph of a tree. I've always loved this photo. I don't know who took it or where the tree is. I reach out and run my hand across the projected leaves and remember the first time I saw it as a boy in my father's office. "Are you lonely?" I ask. "No," he snaps. "Holly would not say that." He pulls the visor from his face and rubs his eyes. Then something catches my attention, something shimmering on his desk to my right. My mother's silver cross on its broken chain. It lies among his files and pieces of broken circuit board like some strange souvenir of his past. "Let's try this again," he mutters, not looking at me as he slips the glowing visor back on his face. I don't think. The second his eyes are covered, I reach out and take back the small cross. Not for its connection with any god, but for its connection with my mother. As the chain slips across the table into my hands, the movement awakens my father's hollow display. "When you're ready, Holly," he barks, waiting for me to begin the rehearsal for Holly's new assignment. But I can't take my eyes off his desk, which is now alive in incredible greens and yellows as this tree of light floats over his work. I've never seen any real trees, not in Central. Its streets were flooded and the ground was way below the waterline when I was born. There was no green, just concrete and clouds, grey. I begin muttering Holly's lines, while my father studies the image of Holly, tweaking her programming with magical waves of his gloved hands in the air. I reach out to his hollow display and clone the file. The tree is mine. It's been my hollow home screen ever since. There for me to look at, to study whenever I please, both as a reminder of the world we destroyed, and a promise of what could be again. This giant plant, towering triumphantly over a grand brick building in the distance. the natural claiming victory over man-made. The sun glistens on the leaves in a way I've never seen. It's real, not like the sun in the dome. I've still never seen a real tree. The ones in the dome don't count. They've been fiddled with, artificially grown to what we consider perfection, but all I see are mutations of their far superior relations. Mother